The others happen to be on the other side of the Willamette River. Just a little jealousy thing.
Senator Miss, if we can drag any of those opportunities east, I'll be very much in support of that.
We're trying.
East of the mountain?
East of any time.
We're working on it.
Mr. Chair, I do just want to, I think you've been handed out a letter of support from the Smart Growth Coalition, too. They wanted me to point that out to you.
Thank you. It's in the packet distributed to members. Members, the mind connection is going to work session. We'll do that now. We are in work session. House Bill 2729.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move House Chair 2729 to the floor with a due pass.
Motion is to move House Bill 2729 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any questions on the motion? Any objections to the motion? So ordered. We would need a carrier for this bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'll carry it.
Senator Minnis will carry.
Thank you.
So ordered. We are now, we'll move to work session on House Bill 2270. And it's the chair's inclination to have the orientation to the amendment from staff. We will not be taking testimony on this bill. Yes, ma'am. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2270A, these are the changes to the historic special assessment program. And you have a summary here of the various amendments. And it starts with a dash A18. And I'll just go through the ones that we've been considering and then one additional one that's brought forth. So with it, dash A18, we talked about it in last hearing. It provides the residential properties with a second 15-year historic special assessment. And then I just put a quick summary there of what the revenue impact was.
Ma'am, let's go ahead and look at the orientation to what is a compromise amendment, and that would be the A26 amendment.
Okay.
Well, since that is the only amendment that has arrived at agreement, so let us talk to that amendment for orientation.
Okay. So with the A26, this is basically allowing one historic property, which first received a historic special assessment as a commercial property and is no longer a commercial property, to receive an extension on their special assessment for 1 year. It applies only to historic properties that are completing a special assessment term after June 30th, 2003, and before July 1st, 2004. This applies to the Irving Street lofts in Portland, and it would result in reduction in revenue of $281,966 in the 2004-05 year. It's just for 1 year.
Further on the order of orientation, did we held our work sessions on this bill? Have we done any amendments to the bill?
Mr. Chairman, you have not adopted any amendments.
Okay. So, unclear to me, Mr. Chair, which ones we want to deal with.
Yeah, and I think that's what we need to discuss for just a second. There was an earlier agreement on a dash 3 amendment, I think, and is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I think the dash A22 was the first amendment that you heard. And that was the one that was a bigger exemption that allowed these certain historic properties, they're no longer, first were commercial, and then they're no longer commercial property, to receive an extension for an additional 15 years. That's the one that then, I think, became the discussion that then arrived at the A26s.
Yeah, there was an amendment that was discussed that was brought by Mr. Linden that had been agreed to, and that... I'm just curious to know what was the disposition of that amendment. Is that also incorporated in the A26?
Mr. Chairman, the dash 3, which when we're talking about the dash 3, we're talking about what the House heard as a dash 3 amendment. But what you heard as a dash A19 is similar to that, and that is the new construction, which is allowing new construction to receive a historic special assessment if approved by the State Historic Preservation Office. So that's the one where it's going to just be for... It's going to contain that new construction to just the square footage cannot exceed the total net rentable area of the property, cannot be less than a total net rentable area prior to the new construction. So the new construction cannot add rentable area to that new construction.
And that had also been the object of agreement, by my understanding. So the issue would be that we'd want to move the dash A-19 to the dash A-26 amendments, I believe. Yes, Senator, I mean.
Just, I've got A-18s in here representing Butler. I don't know what the status of that was.
Those are the ones that became very expensive.
Yeah.
Okay, that was the next. Sorry about that.
So the issue then would be just to go to work session, adopt the A-19s and the A-26 amendments. The chair does have a brief statement to read into the record as well. So we're in work session on House Bill 2270.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move the A-19 amendments to House Bill 2270.
Vice Chair moves the A-19 amendments to House Bill 2270. Are there any questions on the amendment? Any discussion? Hearing seeing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Before we move the A-26, I'm just kind of looking at the back row and would like to see some head nods that these are okay.
The chair will allow the head nodding.
I don't see any going the other way.
Any form of communication other than the chair's comment.
I'm taking that everybody is fully in agreement with these.
Loving the vice chair's incredulity at the notion of agreement here.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Rex,
move the A-26 amendments to House Bill 2270.
The A-26 amendments are moved by the Vice Chair to House Bill 2270. Any questions on the amendment in the motion? Objections? Seeing and hearing none. So ordered, Mr. Vice Chair.
I would move House Bill 2270A as amended to the floor with a due pass.
The motion is to move House Bill 2278 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any questions on the motion? Any objections? So ordered. The chair will carry. Before I close the work session, I have a brief statement to read that's been communicated to us for the record by the League of Oregon Cities. The League of Oregon Cities recognizes the benefits of Historic Property Special Assessment Program and how it contributes to the city's ability to retain buildings that are important to city character and livability. The sole reason that we do not wish to see the program sunset in July 1st, 2002, the League is not opposing an amendment to House Bill 2270 to extend the special assessment for 1 year of certain commercial properties which have been converted to residential properties and for which the special assessment would expire by 2004. Cities do not have the ability to fund additional property tax enhancements to the Historic Property Program. We will oppose similar enhancements in the future because we believe they undermine the integrity of the Historic Property Special Assessment Program, reduce the revenue available for funding municipal services, and convey no discernible public benefit. Colleagues, I want you to know that this these amendments have been agreed to by all of the interested parties in the Historic Property Program, but not without great personal effort by all the parties involved. And the chair wishes to thank those folks from the League of Oregon Cities, those folks from individual cities where significant interests were at stake, and those property owners' representatives who stayed with this process so that we could extend the good public purpose, but also have an agreement on amendment. With that, the work session is closed.
Alrighty then.
Let us move to House Bill 3391. I feel the love in this room. Mr. Waters, so we have orientation for this bill.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3391, we had a public hearing last week. And what it does is it increases the income tax credit available for donations to fiduciary organizations administering individual development accounts. It was brought to our attention during that hearing that some folks wanted amendments drafted that would allow tribal entities to be included among the fiduciary organizations eligible to administer the individual development account. We have those in the form of the dash A7s, which just showed up and should be in front of you. The dash A7s, in addition to authorizing tribal entities to be included as fiduciary organizations for the purposes of administering individual development accounts, also allow IDA's individual development accounts to be rolled over into Oregon College Savings Plan accounts. This language should be the same as you saw last time in the Dash A5 amendment. So basically, the Dash A7s do two things. They combine the Dash A5s, and they also include the tribal entities.
Mr. Waters, when the last we met, we scheduled the work session. We held a public hearing. We learned at that point in time we had inadvertently left out Native American tribes. That's what we've added as an entity that would be eligible under this program. We also incorporated the idea that the rollover potential would be created for individual tuition savings programs. And that is the net effect of A7s. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. We'll go to work session on this.
Yes, sir.
Question before we go there.
Yes, sir.
The A3s? I can't recall. I remember the discussion. I can't recall where we ended up on that. The change from on line 7 for the bill to proposal from 50 to 75.
Correct. Mr. Chair, you also have the dash A3s, which were introduced last time. And what they do are to increase the maximum credit amount to $50,000. I'm sorry, from $50,000 to $75,000, or 75% of amounts donated. So it's an increase in the maximum credit allowed for donation.
Ed, was there a significant difference in the revenue impact?
Senator Byer, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the program has been so undersubscribed since it was initiated that it's difficult to find any revenue impact for the program so far. Proponents indicated that research and experience in other programs in other states required a $75,000 or 75% credit in order to generate.
That was the Enterprise Foundation, folks?
That's correct.
Okay. I'm with it. Mr. Chair?
Actually, Mr. Vice Chair, let me also ask a question about the Dash A5s. Now, the Dash A7s incorporate the Dash A5s, or do you not?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Dash A7s incorporate the Dash A5s.
So what we would need to do is move the Dash A3s and the Dash A7s.
That's correct.
Thank you. Let's go to work session. House Bill 3391. Mr. Vice Chair?
Mr. Chair would move the Dash A3 amendments to House Bill 3391.
The Vice Chair has moved the Dash A3 amendments to House Bill 3391, and that would increase from $50,000 to $75,000 the total amount of credit offered. Any questions on the motion? Objections? Ordered?
Mr. Chair would move the Dash A7 amendments to House Bill 3391.
That motion is to move the Dash A7s into House Bill 3391. The effect of that amendment would be to include the Native American federally recognized Indian tribes and also to allow rollover of individual accounts that have been established for qualified tuition savings programs. Questions on the motion? Objections? Hearing and seeing none, so heard.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3391, A. engrossed, as amended, to the floor with a due pass.
The Vice Chair moves House Bill 3391A and gross as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any questions on the motion? Objections? And seeing none, so ordered. We need a carrier for this good bill. Volunteers? Senator Starr will carry. So ordered. We are closed on the work session on House Bill 3391. Colleagues, let us move now to Senate Bill 188. Let's do that one. It might be a little easier to deal with.
believe.
All right.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with Senate Bill 188, we heard this quite a while ago, and what we had after the first public hearing on this was a work group to discuss some of the details of the bill. There were a few blanks in the bill, and to just discuss the broader issue of property tax incentives for financial institutions making loans to businesses in distressed areas of the state. And since that time, there was a letter kind of summarizing various different members of the work group's opinions and their support in assisting the distressed areas in Oregon by providing loans to businesses in those areas, but they had some other suggestions for tax incentives that may also be effective incentives to financial institutions. So in light of that, Senate Bill 188 and the Dash 3 amendment is going to be replacing the original bill and just authorizing the Economic and Community Development Department to establish a work group to study the lending practices of financial institutions in rural and economically distressed areas, and then also any the effectiveness of tax credits and other incentives for financial institutions. So the group will then report its findings to the next legislative session. So this basically would not have any revenue impact. It would have only a minimal fiscal impact. And the Dash 1, the Dash 2s are just earlier versions, and the Dash 3 actually replaces the original bill, deletes the original bill.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes, sir.
Just a comment.
Absolutely.
Well, thank Vice Chair for at least forming the work group, and I apologize for us not being able to bring back a solid resolution to Senator Gordley and Senator Ferrioli's bill on this. What it did highlight is we sat down in the meeting that we had that there's significant interest and concern about this. The vehicle that we had in front of us, we couldn't seem to find a way to make it work. But we did have a large discussion about the various vehicles that the state has put in place over the years, and I think it's really a good idea to have this task force to take a look at that and come back. And, you know, times have changed a lot since the 80s when most of those were passed, and it's time to take another look.
And I think the real question, Senator, and I appreciate your helping on the working group, is do tax incentives make a difference in lending practices in rural and distressed areas? It's a question we couldn't answer on the working group. It's clear that the financial institutions are meeting the federal requirements for community reinvestment, certainly statistically, yet there's a nagging feeling there's a lot of folks out there who don't have equal access to credit. So we're going to go, Ted, and take a look at this thing and try and find out if maybe we'll learn that the tax incentives are absolutely the least effective incentive to provide for commercial lending since they're so market-driven. And that's something we ought to take a look at, and that's, I think, what this bill would accomplish as amended. So let's go to work session on House Senate Bill 188.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 188.
Dash 3 amendments are moved to Senate Bill 188. That entirely replaces the contents of Senate Bill 188. It does require and authorize a study on tax incentives and lending practices in rural and distressed communities. Questions on the motion? Hearing and seeing none, ordered.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 188 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
The motion is for Senate Bill 188 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions to the motion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Gordley will carry. That will end the work session on Senate Bill 188. We have left, colleagues, one interesting bill, House Bill 2208, and we'll get an orientation to that bill and a slew of amendments that we have for this bill. That's the orientation. Short straw, Mr. Yates, is that the...
have a copy of the bill. I can look at.
So we're doing a gut and stuff here.
It's a modified. It's a modified. Let us orient ourselves to House Bill 2208. Mr. Yates, thank you.
13.
I'm looking at the dash 13 amendments. I was not kidding. I don't have a copy of the original bill, but I guess it's, I've got the 13.
Okay, here's the A endorsed version of House Bill 22.
So does basically this get rid of the whole bill, or does...
No, actually, it's just an amendment.
Okay.
Well, let's take these,
is there anybody in this
look
bill?
At the dash 12 and the dash 13 amendments, and then we'll look at the dash 14 amendments as well.
All right. See, Paul handed this to me a moment ago, and I have not been working this bill.
I think Elizabeth is trying to come up to give you some help here.
We're going to tag team the orientation to this.
I'll talk to the amendments.
I'm sorry, Wett, how are you this morning? This afternoon.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, House Bill 2208, what happened when you already passed out this bill during the last public hearing, and then there were council found some conflicts with another bill dealing with the county biennium budget. So there was an amendment then that needed to be done to conform the conflicts that now exist in law. So that's what your Section 6 does with amending 29480.
Which amendment are you looking at?
And I'm looking at the dash A-12.
A-12, okay.
So this is really the reason why this bill is even before you today. It's because of the A-12.
Is it the chair's intent to work this bill?
Yes, it is.
All right, well, procedurally, we need to reconsider the vote by which we pass.
We do, and we're not in work session yet, but you're absolutely right. And I have a rather detailed script that's been provided by Kim of the Senate Revenue Staff.
I think the suggestion, Mr. Chair, is before we even do public hearings, we probably ought to bring the bill
back.
Let
us do that. Thank you, Senator Dennis, for your instruction. I appreciate that. The chair will consider a motion to suspend the rules on House Bill 2208 for the purpose of reconsidering the bill.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
And are we in work session? We need to be in work session to have a motion. Work session on House Bill 2208. Would you restate your motion, Mr. Vice Chair? To suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsideration.
You restated my motion very well.
Objections to the motion? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would move that the committee reconsider the vote by which it took. Passed House Bill 2208.
The motion is to reconsider the vote by which the committee sent House Bill 2208 to the floor with a due pass, the recommendation as amended. Questions on the motion? Hearing and seeing none, objections? So ordered.
Now you have the bill in front of you.
Okay, let's again launch into the orientation on the...
Did you open the public hearing?
Believe we're in work
session. Work session? Where's that?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, you have the dash A-12 in front of you, and this is dealing with resolving the conflicts with another bill that has already passed. And all that's changed there is on page 2 of the amendment, we put in the language, a local option describing this section is certified for extension on the assessment and tax roll for the fiscal year, and they just added in or budget period. So that's the only change that's made in that statute in order to conform it with the bill that's already passed. And then it just continues on page 3, line 19 is where your dash A-10 amendment that you adopted in the last hearing begins. So this just adds to the A-10 amendment in order to resolve the conflict.
I'm sorry, which amendment is this?
This is A-12. Okay, this is the one, it says right at the beginning, including amendments to resolve conflict.
So this fixes the problem in the
problem in the bill you already passed.
All right.
Okay, let's deal with that fix first and take this A-12 amendment off the table by incorporating it.
Mr. Chair, move the A-12 amendments to House Bill 2208.
The motion is to move A-12 amendments to House Bill 2208 A engrossed. Any questions to the motion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Okay.
Now let's move to the dash 13 amendment.
Okay, now we need this. Okay.
We're staffing them by amendment.
Those hands are jammed in his pocket.
Elizabeth got out of here.
Chair's still hot.
Mr. Yates.
We have a lot of different types of alcoholic beverages that find their way into the market one way or the other.
Now we're on the A13 section.
The A13 amendments to House Bill 2208. And these amendments deal with the taxation of a particular type of alcoholic beverage. And that's a beverage which is made by combining something with hard liquor. So it's not a wine, it's not a malt beverage, it's not a cider. And currently, as a result of that, it is sold through OLCC and through the agent's distribution centers. And in Section 30, what you have is a change in the word there, wording of what is distilled liquor, line 21 through 23. And that makes it clear that a low-proof distilled beverage is not distilled liquor and therefore not subject to OLCC distribution. And then on the next page you have a definition in line 2 of what a low-proof distilled beverage is. And that means an alcoholic beverage that is made by combining distilled liquor with other liquids and that contains not more than 14% alcohol by volume.
Thank you, Ms. Hughes. I'd like to, by invitation, call forward Paul Cosgrove, Christina McNitt.
While they're coming up, what you do then, in terms of, once you move it outside OLCC, there's no longer 100% markup. It generates revenue.
Right.
And what this does is impose a tax at the same rate that table wine is taxed at.
Just
67 cents per gallon.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome. The purpose of this amendment is...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this issue of low-proof distilled spirits is actually going to appear before the body in two separate bills. This is a companion to a bill that will be reviewed by the House and then eventually by this body. In that bill, we provide that these beverages, and Christina has placed in front of you two of the comparison beverages for your information, these beverages could be sold in various kinds of licensees that OLCC licenses. That's the companion bill. But because of a constitutional issue and because there's a tax being imposed, the tax portion of this bill is before you today in 2208. It has a provision in lines... it's the very last section of the bill. It's on page, or of the amendment, page 8, lines 1 through 7, that this tax does not come into effect unless the companion bill is adopted. And the companion bill will have a provision that if the tax isn't adopted, the companion bill doesn't come into play. So we're having to split the issue into two pieces because of the constitutional issue, the tax revenue raising issue that need to be addressed in a House bill. The low-proof distilled spirits that you see here is this bottle. It's a lemonade product. It has exactly the same alcohol content as this other bottle, which is also a lemonade product. This one, the alcohol is made by a brewing process. It's basically beer-based. This one, the alcohol is made by a distilling process. And under our current law, even though these products are essentially identical, the distribution is handled very differently as well as the markup and tax. This proposal to establish a new tax on these products would be necessary in order to allow them to be sold in grocery stores along with these products. And that's the proposal that we have in the substantive bill that will be heard later. This is just the tax portion. This is a measure that is on which the OLCC is neutral. The chair of the OLCC is, in fact, supportive. The Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse is also neutral in the Department of Human Services, and it's because alcohol is alcohol is alcohol, and people's view is, regardless of how the alcohol is manufactured, if it's the same alcohol level, it should be distributed and treated as the same. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Minister, do you have a question?
Is this, for staff, is this revenue neutral?
This, Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, this particular piece is actually revenue positive because this establishes the tax. The other piece will eliminate the markup, and the two together will be ever so slightly revenue positive by about $30,000 based on our estimates, and we're going to be working with legislative revenue to make sure.
Just for staff again, does this include the tax rate on all table wines and others at 67 cents per gallon?
Is that current rate?
Is it comparable?
No, no, is this, the language in this bill restricted only to these products, or cover all of those kinds of products?
In other words, does it change the tax?
The tax is imposed only on this new definition, which I forget, but it's a low-proof distilled beverage.
I have a little prescription reimbursement, and I'd like to fund.
Well, Senator Minnis, actually, because this is ever so slightly revenue positive by $30,000, that means the body's obligated to spend $90,000 of that revenue.
I was just thinking about doubling the tax.
Yeah.
If I may, you asked a question of staff with respect to the revenue impact statement, and I will do one on this amendment, but I saw it just a couple of minutes ago. And the answer to your question really depends on what you think is going to happen to the volume. Clearly, the 67-cent tax is less than 100% markup currently. So on a per-bottle basis, you lose money.
So you make it up to the volume?
Maybe. Maybe you do.
Mr. Chairman, if I might address that issue. This change has been made in 8 out of the 18 control states. We're a control state, as you are aware. 8 of the 18 states have made this change. Most recently, it was made in the state of Virginia, and we have information that we'll be providing legislative revenue about how changes happened, and we believe based on those, what happened in Virginia, this will be slightly revenue positive. What happens is some people who did buy this, and this is taxed at 8 cents a gallon, and this will be taxed at 67 cents a gallon. So we have that information, but we believe based on other states' experience, it will be slightly, ever so slightly, not worth mentioning so slightly, revenue positive.
Further questions?
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
False revenue, Jeff.
Ms. McNiff, do you have anything you wish to add?
My colleague Paul's done a great job, but for the record, I will state I'm Christina McNitt, and I'm representing Brown-Forman, and we produce Jack Daniel's.
I may not have mentioned that I represent Distilled Spirits Council of the United States. I don't remember if I said that for the record, Paul.
Thank you. I have a serious question here. You said one's going to be taxed at 8 cents, the other's going to be taxed at
67 cents.
And do we create a constitutional problem in terms of tax policy with similar products being taxed at different rates?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, I don't believe so. In that, right now, this is 8 cents and this is 100% markup. And it's never been challenged. And I believe the state is constitutionally able to, based on the amendment we adopted when we ended prohibition, to treat these beverages differently. We have for years and years.
Okay, but you probably know a lot more about this than I do, but if you have two very similar products sold in the same way, taxed on a per gallon basis, and one's at 8 cents, one's at 67 cents, is there supposed to be a justification for that that's defensible?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, to keep it revenue neutral. I mean, it's very practical. We're going to impose a tax high enough to keep it revenue neutral, for obvious reasons. The body has other projects to fund.
Anywhere here, Mr. B.
The Jack Daniel's product, what's the alcoholic content?
Mr. Chair, members, this is 5.9% alcohol by volume.
And that's why it's taxed essentially as malt beverage, or in that same category. It's treated as cider.
Right.
And this product is up to 14%.
Mr. Chair, members...
Well, the one that's taxed at 8 cents is at 14% alcohol. The lesser ones...
These are both
7%. So that makes a lot of sense.
No, it's just the opposite.
Oh, it's just the opposite.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, members, these products are all allowed to go up to 14%, and they're all considered low-proof products. What's interesting is already in statute, you may be familiar with something called wine coolers. I didn't bring an example of that, but wine coolers today are no longer made out of wine because their rate is at 67 cents per gallon. Now they're actually made out of a brewed product, just like this. But we already have that statutory differentiation between the tax rates.
I'm actually just trying to see if I can get Paul Romaine making a mad dash.
Mr. Chair, I think they're just making the case that the beer tax is too low.
For those listening at home, many, many open palms were held, and distancing motions were made.
Mr. Chairman, could I state on behalf of the people that these people here are not your friends?
Oh, thank you, Senator. So that is the purpose of the A-13 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other person here present that wishes to offer testimony on the A-13? No, seeing and hearing none. That was invited testimony for the work session. We are in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move the A-13 to House Bill 2208.
We have a motion for the A-13 amendments to be moved into House Bill 2208. Any questions on the motion? Objections to the motion? Hearing and seeing none. So order. A-14. Eyes are up. Yes, sir. Mr. Representative Witt, do you wish to address the A-14 amendment? Absolutely, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Very briefly, in the 1999 session, I introduced a bill, House Bill 2901, that became law that expanded out our current low-income senior property tax deferral program to include low-income disabled property owners. The way that program has worked is that if you have income less than $27,500 and you wish to defer your property taxes, you can do so. The state then pays the county distributes the proceeds to the various government entities that would benefit from the property tax. The state takes a lien on the property and charges a 6% interest rate. The program has actually been running in the black for the state. It has not been costing the state any money. In fact, the state has been bringing in more money than it's been paying out the last several biennia. In House Bill 2208, as it left the House and came here to the Senate, it raised the threshold from $27,500 to $32,000 to correct an anomaly in the program that exists in current law, which is your income must be below $27,500 to qualify for the program, but to continue on the program, your income can go as high as $32,000. So the bill, the way you passed it out of this committee, which is the way it came from the House originally, raised that threshold to $32,000. So someone who is low income, disabled, or senior would qualify for the property tax deferral program with an income under $32,000. And then to stay on the program, their income simply had to stay below $32,000, and it was indexed for inflation. What the -14s do is they also provide the deferral to a service-connected disabled person or a disabled veteran. It allows that disabled veteran to access the program, as it exists today, have the state pay to the county the property taxes, again, take a deferral on the property taxes. The state then takes a lien and charges the 6% interest rate and collects on the lien together with the interest at the time that the property is sold at some point down the road. So that's basically what the -14s do.
So in a nutshell, Representative Witt, what this does is make the eligibility income consistent with the maintenance income of $32,500.
Yes, and then with the -14s, it expands it out to a service-connected disabled person to authorize to allow them to use the program.
And as we heard before, that does have an impact on revenue. It is, I believe, not a significant impact.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, you heard the same amendment briefly when we heard 2282 dealing with the war veterans exemption. With this amendment, what you're doing is removing the income requirement for disabled veterans that are 70% or more service-related disabled. And the Department of Revenue has updated and talked with the War Veterans Administration as far as getting a better handle on how many total veterans are 70% or more disabled. And they came up with a total of like 5,493 veterans. And then when you're applying a home ownership rate and then looking at a percent that are actually going to be applying, it's looking like in the first year, which would be 2002-03, there would be 825 new applicants for a revenue, additional revenue amount of $1.48 million for the program. And then the second year would be a little bit bigger, 925 applicants, $1.66 million. Third year, 1,000 applicants at $1.84 million.
However, as we've discussed before, this is not an exemption, it's a deferral.
Yes, but Mr. Chairman, this is additional revenue that the Department of Revenue will need to, in order to be able to make the payments to the county. This is amount that will be eventually paid back by the disabled population, but it is money that will first need to be given to the Department of Revenue through an appropriation for that program, and then they can make the payments to the county.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, what did you have discussions on how that was to be accomplished?
Well, Elizabeth, I'm curious as to, did you account for the fact that many of these people probably are under the program already, under current statute?
Well, Representative Witt, I think a portion of them, yes, could be under the program, but there's an age limit of 32,000, or will be 32,000, so...
Yeah, I just make the point, Mr. Chairman, that what we're talking about here, I think, is a relatively small number of people who don't qualify for the program now, but who could qualify under the Dash 14s, who then would have to make the option to apply for the program. Most service-connected disabled veterans probably have income below $32,000 already, and if they saw benefit in the program, they've already been qualified to make application to the program. So, I don't mean to take exception. I haven't looked at the actual revenue projection here impact, but I just find it hard to believe it's that big.
Question, Senator Minnis?
Oh, okay, I'm trying to figure out, because I'm not sure what you just said.
I mean, try again.
Well, you said they would already be qualified. If they're already qualified, well, how does this bill help them?
Because some of them could have income above the $32,000 threshold. In other words, the ones that are below the income threshold now, who are service-connected disabled, they already have had the opportunity to apply for the program because they qualify as a disabled individual who has income below the threshold. So the only ones that this would open the program up to, the deferral program, is to those who would have income above the income threshold and are service-connected disabled. I can't believe that's a very high percentage of the people that would access the program.
Okay, I'm still trying to figure out, above the 32, so that's everybody,
yes.
any disabled 70% disability or more would be able to apply for the deferral program, notwithstanding their income.
That's correct. Under the Dash 14.
Under the Dash 14. So they can make $150,000 a year.
They could.
And they would qualify.
For the deferral, they would, yes.
I see.
But I also would point out, Mr. Chairman, to the committee that the people that are going to access this program are people that can't afford to pay their property taxes.
Or don't want.
They're not getting away from their property taxes, and they're paying an interest on it. They're paying a 6% interest on it as it accumulates. So, but yeah, Senator, you correct. You could have a service-connected disabled veteran who has an income of $150,000 who could apply for this program, and under this language would be qualified. The point that I'm making, though, is that if you look at the revenue forecast, I find it hard to believe that there's that many service-connected disabled veterans above $32,000, because those under $32,000 are already eligible, assuming that this amendment from 27 to 32 becomes law. They're already eligible. And the ones above $32,000, like the one, as Senator Minnis said, if you had one that made $150,000, I find it hard. I don't think many of them would apply for the program. They lose lots of things, too. They lose the deduction in terms of their federal and state taxes. They still don't get away from the taxes. I mean, this program is not something anybody gets rich on. This is a program that people can't afford to pay their property taxes might take advantage of. But anyhow, that's what the Dash 14s do.
Senator Castillo?
I'm very supportive of Representative Witt's amendment here. I'm just hoping that it doesn't, I'm kind of wondering what we do here, because are we going to have to send this to Ways and Means? And if we do that, does this hurt the whole bill? I want to figure out a way that we can accomplish this, because I think it's something we should do.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Vice Chair?
Representative, does the term service-connected disability, is it matter what level of disability? Find that someplace?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, you have to be 70% or more.
70% or more?
Yeah, 70% or more service-connected disabled under the language. So it's 10% disability or, you know, a minor disability doesn't qualify.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, where did we get 70%? What is that? What's the rationale?
If you have technical support, you may as well call them forward for the record.
This is my technical support, Mr. Chairman. It's Mr. John Roach, who's a constituent, who's a service-connected disabled veteran.
Yes, Mr. Roach, I remember your testimony from my earlier meeting. Welcome.
Thank you. So you mentioned the 70%. My name is John Roach. I live in Beaverton, Oregon.
And address your comments to Senator Minnis, who asked the question. Where did we get the 70%?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yes, Senator Minnis. Your question on 70%?
Yeah, why 70%? Where does it come from?
Because 70% under the VA system is a portion cutoff area where they consider a veteran to be unemployable. And there are programs that you fall under if you're 70%, which is called an individual unemployment, which allows you to raise your status financially so your children can also receive benefits for school.
All right. So, Mr. Chairman, that sounds to me like a fairly reasonable rationale then to justify the limitations that Representative Witt's talking about, that the assumption is that you probably aren't going to find very many of these folks out there making $150,000 a year, because the assumption at 70% is they are unemployable.
Correct.
We may or may not know whether that's true, but then it's something for me to say.
You have to go through a major battery of tests to reach that qualification in the VA for.
So somebody making that kind of income probably be the exception rather than the rule.
It'd be an exception. And again, any person who is able to pay their property taxes, it'd be very smart to pay them. Why put yourself into an indebtedness? But I can only speak from my own experience. I have two teenage daughters. I have both of my daughters have some major medical problems. What this does is give the veteran the ability to if he's stuck between a rock and a hard place, he's able to use the funding for that to help his family or what a major need that might be. I couldn't see going out and just deferring property taxes just because you have the ability to do it. And if my children were older and I had the money, I certainly wouldn't even want to put my property taxes in indebtedness. But this just helps a veteran that really needs it and is trying to raise their kids or whatever financial situation might be with their wife or something. It gives them some ability to have the wealth to work.
I think that's a rational argument. The question remaining is the one Senator Castillo raised, and that's the fiscal impact of whether or not this destines it to an untimely death in Ways and Means.
Mr. Chairman, if I can respond.
Please do.
To Senator Castillo's question is referred back here by Senator Minnis. I think, Senator, when you look at, and by the way, the 70% is defined on page 4 at the top of the bill, so where it defines service-connected disabled person as being service-connected disabilities of 70% or more. Senator Castillo, though, I think that I just heard this revenue projection. I'm just dubious.
Yeah.
Because, first, we're not just talking about service-connected disabled people. We're talking about service-connected disabled 70% or more, which defines them as, according to the services, being unemployable. Not many of these people are going to be making more than $32,000, and those that are, those that are below $32,000 are going to qualify anyhow under the bill without the Dash 14s. Those that are over $32,000, I don't think most of them would apply for it anyhow, except those probably marginally over, because they don't have the means to pay the property taxes. So we're talking about people who have not only a service-connected disability, as Senator Minnis pointed out, but 70% service-connected disability. So I just find it hard to believe it has that big of a revenue impact.
Actually, colleagues, we're looking at the first year estimate of 825 new applications, or put it this way, 825 new applications, but we do not know what percentage of those are already qualified at 27.5. And the assumption is that the revenue projections are based on none of them having qualified. And in fact, probably the majority of them are qualified at 27.5. So there's only a portion of them that would be new applicants, and that's indeterminable at this point. So I guess the question before the committee is if we believe that there are a relatively small number of Oregonians who are service-connected disabled, at least 70% with incomes of $32,500 or lower, which seems to me to be a fairly narrow qualification. Then the assumption may be that there is a less significant revenue impact than possibly stated.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm very sympathetic to where this is going. I wonder if I'm not sure how quickly we need to pass. This has already come through the House, so we just need to come to an end. If there's time to hold it over, I suspect we have yet one more meeting. So
well, we have two choices. We can move this bill to Ways and Means, and we can have the co-chairs look at that revenue impact and make a determination, or we can move the bill to the floor and pass the bill, and then between there and the question of concurrence by the co-chair in the House, sharpen our pencils and come up with the revenue impact and talk to the co-chairs about their ability to...
I'm trying to think through this. Maybe Senator Menes can help me. The problem would be is if we go with $3 million revenue impact, effectively, as we meet our challenge to balance the budget, that means that we will, if we think it's less than that, we're putting a $3 million hole in the budget.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to reduce the expenditure targets by $3 million unless we can reduce that revenue impact.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Menes.
One other possible suggestion is, I don't know whether we have other vehicles relating to taxation here that might be available to the committee, but rather than bind everything else up with this particular amendment,
Mr. Chairman,
a separate bill.
Question.
Yeah, I have another suggestion maybe that would satisfy the committee, and that is if you move the bill to the floor and it passes on the floor, in the meantime, I'll work with Legislative Revenue Office to try to refine this number. And if it's above some level, maybe that the committee states today that it thinks is unacceptable, I'll ask, specifically, I'll ask Representative Shetterly not to concur, and we'll go to conference and we'll try to work it out in conference.
Question, Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, the difficulty you're going to have, the Senate President is going to require it to go to Ways and Means, and it's more than
10,000. And I think in view of the delicacy of budget negotiations, not to do that would be...
Why don't we just take a look at it? There's no greater urgency to pass this one today, is there?
Well, I'll ask Representative Witt. We had a meeting with the President about this bill this morning, as a matter of fact, another bill. So if we don't take action on this bill today, we'd have to get the President's permission to rehear it at a future time. I think it should be known to the committee that there are at least three suggestions that the Legislative Revenue Committee has come up with for reducing the potential impact on this, and perhaps it would be worth holding the bill over one more opportunity and working with the co-chairs and making sure that if we do need to take a revenue impact, a reduction, that we have a strategy to do that, or if we can refine the revenue projections, that... that be done before the bill moves out to the floor and upsets the apple cart on budget negotiations.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I would strongly recommend that we allow Representative Witt and work with the fiscal staff to take another look at it, because I think he raises some big points, and my suspicion is that number is less than that. Since it's already passed the House, I don't see a big problem getting the bill out if we can make it fit financially.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, when the bill went through the House, we did not have the amendment to the $32,500. Is that correct?
We had the amendment to $32,000, Mr. Chairman. We didn't have this specific amendment to... The bill came to the House for the $32,000.
All right, so...
But it didn't have the service-connected 70% disabled...
Qualifier. Which would reduce the pool.
Yes.
Do we have revenue impact projected in the House bill?
I think those are the...
Let's do that.
Yes, Mr. President.
Let's hold it over and do it the next time.
Okay. Colleagues, let me just poll the committee on their relative support for the coinciding the $32,500 maintenance threshold with the application threshold. Anybody have any strenuous objections, or do we think that's a great idea? Clearly, the committee's in... very much in favor of making this change. The question is how do we deal with the revenue impact. So what we're going to do is hold the bill over on the question of revenue impact, and we'll go petition the President for another opportunity to return to work session on this bill. Meantime, Representative Wood, I will work with you and Legislative Fiscal to make sure that we get the sharpest possible pencil applied to the number of new applications to determine what the best guesstimate will be on revenue impact, and then subsequently, if we need to work with the co-chairs, there are at least three different strategies for reducing the revenue impact that may be worth exploring. Colleagues, I would have loved to move this bill today, but I think in good conscience, the only thing we can do with this revenue impact is to move it to Ways and Means, I think we can accomplish that with the meeting and keep the bill in committee. Any objections, questions, final comments? Close the work session on Senate Bill 2729A. And we are in adjournment, and colleagues, I must remind you that we meet only at the authorization of the president. So, oh, before we leave, Mr. Waters reminds me, or at least notifies me, informs me, that we have an internal conflict on House Bill 3391. As amended, we have to suspend the rules, reopen the bill, make a small technical adjustment.
Well, Mr. Chair, I move to suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering House Bill 3391.
The motion is made to suspend the rules for the specific purpose of reconsidering the vote by which we passed out Senate Bill 3391. Any objections to the motion? So,
Mr. Chair, I move that we reconsider the passage of 3391.
The motion is to reconsider 3391. Any objections, questions, orders? What, Ed?
Mr. Chair, I move the conflict amendment that Ed Waters has.
Mr. Chair, apparently the SA7 amendments that we adopted with the language about including Indian tribes or bands, federally recognized Indian tribes or bands, as fiduciary organizations was too narrow in that it restricts them to be fiduciary organizations only for the purposes of rolling over individual development accounts into Oregon Savings Plan accounts.
And the purpose really was to recognize them as fiduciary agents in total.
More broadly, yeah, for individual development account administration.
Okay.
So we can fix that by a conceptual amendment, removing part of all of line 13, or after the B in parens on line 13, moving the rest of that line, and up through the comma on line 14 below that. So,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Waters restated my conceptual motion excellently.
The conceptual motion is to remove the language in line 13 and the language in line 14 through the comma before the word A. That is the conceptual motion. Any questions on the motion? We will have a further motion to withdraw the due pass recommendation on House Bill 3391 in order to fully...
I thought that was part of my motion.
Yeah.
My mistake.
So the motion is to withdraw the due pass recommendation and to conceptually amend the bill as stated by the chair. Questions on the motion? Yes, Yes, Senator Minnison, if you could
just say
another minute.
We're fixing the technical.
We essentially amended Senate Bill 3391 to the point where it was so narrow that the recognition of the status of the federally recognized tribes only applied to the specific issue of savings accounts.
Not to sound terribly stupid, but what'd you do 2208?
We're having to hold it over.
Oh, okay.
Unfortunately. So the amendment before the committee, if I can remember it all, is to rescind the vote by which we passed the floor with the due pass recommendation and to conceptually amend the bill on line 13, striking all of line 13 and striking line 14 to the comma. That of course appears in line 14, and that will solve the problem.
Mr. Chair, if I may, approximately, we need to strike out, and I will quote, on line 13 after B in parens, we need to strike out, in the case of individual development accounts established for the purpose described in ORS 458.6851C, comma.
So moved.
That's on the dash 7 amendment.
On the motion, any objections to the motion? So ordered. No, I was just starting to like this committee.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Once again, I would move House Bill 3391A to the floor as amended to do pass.
Any questions on the motion?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I just thank you for going through this much trouble so I could vote on this bill.
Yes, sir. No problem. objections to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. And did we not designate Senator Starr as the carrier of this bill? Or who was the carrier of this bill?
He was.
Yes, Senator Starr, would you still, in the face of these dubious amendments?
I would so do, yes.
Senator Starr, we are in, we're closed the work session on House Bill 3391. The committee is closed until the order of the president.